With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn on what you want, like trying out that new workout class, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like a foam roller for your sore muscles. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
Hello there. I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Toddcast. So, after 9/11, the CIA began detaining people who they believed had information about the next attack. In custody, they used a brutal and what turned out later ineffective method of questioning known as enhanced interrogation techniques. Outside groups would later simply call it torture. My guest today is filmmaker Alex Gibney. His new documentary, The Forever Prisoner, comes out December 6th on HBO, and it focuses on Abu Zubaydah. He is the first high-value detainee who was subjected to the CIA's program. Zubaydah, of course, is still in U.S. custody, and yes, Guantanamo Bay is still open, even after we've left Afghanistan. This new film is kind of a sequel to Gibney's Oscar-winning 2007 movie, Taxi to the Dark Side. That film tracked the extrajudicial killing of an Afghan taxi driver at Bagram Air Base. Alex, welcome to the Toddcast.
Thanks, Chuck.
Let's talk about, first of all, getting the access you needed to accomplish this documentary, including having to file lawsuits. How much sooner could this documentary have been made if you hadn't had to file these suits?
A lot sooner. I mean, the fact is, it probably only was possible to do it in the last couple of years. And that was one of the reasons for embarking on this project, because, you know, in Taxi to the Dark Side, which was made in 2006, released in 2007, you know, we were on the trail of what we thought was the CIA's involvement in Abu Ghraib and other things, mm-hmm. but we weren't really able to follow it because so much was kept secret. And so it was only recently when we launched some lawsuits against the CIA, which resulted in the unredacting of Ali Soufan's book and his ability to testify about the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, and also our ability to get some other documents and drawings from Abu Zubaydah himself, and then also our ability to interview James Mitchell at great length. And James Mitchell was the architect of enhanced interrogation techniques.
I want to start with Mitchell. Did he come willingly, or did he always want to come willingly, or was he sort of reluctant to talk to you?
He came willingly. I should say that this project started when two people came to me from different corners. One, Ray Bonner, noted former New York Times journalist, mm-hmm. And also Kathy Scott Clark, another very talented and accomplished journalist. Kathy had the relationship with Mitchell and had embarked on a series of conversations with him and persuaded him to talk at some length. And I and Kathy and Ray all ganged up on him and interrogated him for about 6 hours one day.
Interrogated him. There's a choice of words there.
Exactly.
He doesn't regret what he did, but does he admit it doesn't work?
No, he doesn't. And neither does the CIA. But I don't think there's any evidence that that has been shown that can possibly conclude that enhanced interrogation techniques did anything whatsoever to advance the ball, particularly in the case of Abu Zubaydah. Everything important that was learned from him was learned through traditional rapport building techniques. All they got from Abu Zubaydah was him telling them what they wanted to hear, even though they knew it was false.
So the status of Zubaydah now and the status of Gitmo in general, I mean, it's kind of a, you know, Barack Obama signed that executive order on January 20th, 2009. Not only is Gitmo open, I don't know when it's ever going to close.
Yeah, it's a really serious problem, and it's a deep stain on the United States. And the Zubaydah case in particular is problematic. I mean, we called this film The Forever Prisoner because we stumbled upon a cable from the black side in Thailand just before they were about to torture Zubaydah. And the cable essentially said, look, When we embark on this method of interrogation, he may die. And if he dies, don't worry. We'll cremate him. Nobody will ever know. But if he lives, we want your assurance that he's not going to talk to anybody ever again about what happened to him. And the cable came back from Washington, and part of this is a direct quote. Mm-hmm. Rest assured, he will remain incommunicado for the remainder of his life. And so that's now where he sits, incommunicado.
No due process.
No due process. He's never been permitted to challenge his detention, and he's never been charged with a crime.
There have been people on his and others' behalf that have tried to make this due process argument. Where are those? What's the status of those cases?
They're lingering. In the case of Abu Zubaydah, they're not. The courts are not reckoning with those requests. Now, Abu Zubaydah's name did pop up recently in the Supreme Court as a result of a legal initiative to try to get more information about torture in Poland. Abu Zubaydah was transferred to Poland briefly after Thailand. And there was a lot of arguing in the Supreme Court and some shock. I say shock kind of like in the way that Claude Rains said shock in Casablanca. Shock on the part of some of the justices at the fact that there hadn't been any due process for Abu Zubaydah at Guantanamo. And the Supreme Court justices wondered why. And the government was not really prepared for a good answer to that question. And so there may be a chance, and the Supreme Court is considering it now, that Abu Zubaydah himself will finally testify about what happened to him in Poland.
What? How many folks do we have left in Gitmo?
I believe it's 39. Yeah. Now, some of those have been cleared for release but have not yet left, but I think it's 39.
And most of it is supposed to be it's supposed to be transfers to other countries.
That's correct. Now, there are a few who are awaiting trial by military commissions.
Right.
And
those trials have been delayed for years.
Years and years and years, because that was essentially a kind of a joke. It was an attempt to set up a kind of kangaroo court where there would be guaranteed convictions. But it turned out that was exactly the wrong thing to do for all sorts of bureaucratic reasons and because of the forceful defense, I should add, by military JAGs who are assigned to do their job assiduously. They haven't moved forward at all, whereas all of the cases that have been tried in federal courts have been adjudicated.
Have we heard from Abu Zubaydah's family?
Well, his brother is in the film. His brother lives in the United States. And, you know, we reached out to him to talk about, Abu Zubaydah's past, because it was interesting to kind of learn a little bit about who Abu Zubaydah was.
Who was he? Yeah.
So Abu Zubaydah is...
Who do you feel like he is? Like, you know, a picture was painted of him by the U.S. government.
A picture was painted of him as kind of a radical religious zealot. I think he had a political agenda. There's no doubt about that. He was a Palestinian who grew up in Saudi Arabia, spent a number of years traveling the world. And then as a result of animus towards Israel and the United States for enabling Israel, ended up going to Afghanistan in pursuit of jihad. And after being wounded there, a very bad head wound, he ended up becoming a kind of jack of all trades, kind of like a travel agent for jihadis and also getting people in and out of a training facility in Afghanistan called.
So he certainly was assisting terrorists.
There's no doubt about that.
And the question of whether he was a leader or not, though, I mean, he was sort of. Sounds like you're painting the picture of a middleman.
He was kind of a middleman. Now he was involved in stuff, but he was never, as the CIA claimed, the number three in Al Qaeda. That was just a fiction. Invented by some analysts at the CIA, and ultimately, it was repudiated by the CIA itself. Even though they continued to argue to the Justice Department that he should be tortured because he was the number three man in Al Qaeda, he was never a member of Al Qaeda ever.
Alex, what is your? You've done a lot of. You've butted heads with the CIA in the past, and different things you've made. You know, you talk to folks individually off the record, and none of them. You know, feel good about what happened in this period of time. But where is the demand to clean it up? right? Where has been the, you know, there's been a few calls in Congress, but how come there isn't more of an internal outcry on this?
I really don't understand it. And, well, I shouldn't say I really don't understand it. I have an idea, but it's depressing because actually, as you have done, Chuck, I've spoken to a lot of people inside the CIA that were outraged at the time that this was happening and continue.
Yeah, they fought it. They were, I'm not going to out people as sources, but they were sounding an alarm. Yeah.
100%. And we mentioned some of them in the film, but they're not permitted to raise their voices. The only people who are permitted to raise their voices and who get clearance to reveal previously classified information are the ones who toe the line. Now, it's interesting that three people who are characters in this story, George Tenet, Jose Rodriguez, who was head of the Counterterrorism Center, and also James Mitchell, the contractor who was hired to invent the EITs, the memoirs of all three of those gentlemen were written by the same man, Bill Harlow, from the CIA. Now,
suddenly doesn't sound legitimate. You're like, wow, the same guy writes the memoirs for these guys? Jesus.
Yeah. Okay, let's put it through the...
let's put it through our CIA publishing machine, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. So what you have is you have an agency that's not interested in revealing that it ever makes mistakes. And, you know, it's interesting. One of the reasons you do docs like this and people write books and people write articles and we investigate history is you want to find out about the mistakes and hopes that you won't repeat them in the future. As the head of Toyota once said, mistakes are precious. Why? Because they help you get it right the next time. But for the CIA, mistakes are classified.
Right. It's always sweeping under the rug. Gina Haspel and John Brennan, did you try?
We did. And the answer was no. I mean, I'm not sure. Did we reach out to Brennan? Brennan wasn't as essential to this story as Gina Haspel was. Gina Haspel was responsible for destroying the videotapes of Abu Zubaydah's torture. So she was relevant to the story. We reached out and she did not agree to be interviewed.
She's somebody, it's funny, I expect her to talk in like 20 years, but not now. There is something, the Trump years made her clam up even more, if that was possible.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to some field agents who speak very highly of Gina Haspel.
Said she's very well regarded.
She always had their back. But when having your back means destroying evidence of a crime, you've crossed the line, clearly. And yet, despite that action, she was elevated to become head of the CIA.
You know, I hesitate to ask this question this way, but because so many documentaries have helped spark new interest in subjects that need to have some new scrutiny, do you hope this doc gets more politicians to start asking questions about Abu Zubaydah?
I hope so.
What the hell he's doing there? Yeah.
What the hell is he doing there? What the hell are we doing keeping Guantanamo?
We're out of Afghanistan, but we're not out of Gitmo.
Correct.
Right?
And yeah. It's a joke. It's become a bad joke. And you know, for years, a number of senators kind of ginned up the danger of Guantanamo and said we can never have them on U.S. soil. That would be too dangerous. Well, look at, you know, Florence, Colorado, the supermax there. There are a lot of bad guys there. And we feel perfectly safe. You know, it's a kind of fundamental hypocrisy and cowardice that we're not closing Gitmo. Because the only reason it's there was to be a place outside the law. And so long as we claim to believe in the rule of law, we should shut it down.
No, it is a hypocritical one. I mean, there's a lot of hypocrisy these days, but that's a big one. What do you make of this moment? In the business world, they call this the hockey stick moment for documentary filmmakers. But we are in a moment, right, where it is, and I guess part of it is it's never, the barrier to entry's never been lower, right? Access, you know, you don't have to know the one art house theater in your neighborhood or in your town that might show some of these. I feel like it's really becoming almost now a fixture in our journalism circles, more of a fixture than ever before.
Agreed. And I think there's a lot of reasons for it. I think one of the big reasons was a business reason, which is that, you know, for all sorts of distribution reasons, the economics of documentary meant that audiences began to pay for the product itself, to see the documentaries via cable, pay cable and streaming, right, rather than, you know, being the product, the audiences being the product themselves and hawked to advertisers by shows. And the other reason I think is that, you know, in the last 15 years, docs have gotten better and better and better and better, as they become an intriguing kind of form, which is intensely fact-based and fact is stranger and just as dramatic as fiction, but also with a sense of authorship by very talented filmmakers who compel people just like the author of a really good nonfiction book.
Right. It is a it is a compelling, certainly a narrative that some would argue that, you know, if you do the narrative well, you can cover up some facts. And that's always a, that, you know, that, I guess that's a line that, that other, you know, I've had some documentary filmmakers who claim, hey, don't call me a journalist. I'm telling a story. I'm not into journalism. I sort of view it as, yes, you are, but I understand at least the attempt at that distinction. Do you?
I guess so. I mean, I call myself a filmmaker with journalistic baggage, which is to say,
I love that.
I don't intend.
That's my dream, actually, is to be a filmmaker with journalistic baggage.
You know, I think it's wrong to fool the audience. I think it's wrong to intentionally bend or break the facts. That said, I think stories are important. And by the way, journalists, even in the course of writing a piece for a daily newspaper, journalists convey their facts not as you would in a list of a. Of names and addresses in a phone book, but in the context of a story. In fact, this, I remember very clearly the story I read that got me interested in Taxi to the Dark Side was a journalistic account in the New York Times about Dilawar, this young taxi driver who was murdered at the Bagram Air Force Base by a very talented storyteller named Tim Golden. Now, he was a journalist, but he was also telling a story. So I think that, you know, there are always people who either recklessly or carelessly get facts wrong, and sometimes purposefully. I don't subscribe to that at all. But at the same time, I don't apologize for telling a very compelling story. I think, by and large, that's how people learn, is through stories. We all tell each other stories.
I'm completely, in fact, as I know that there's less and less individual trust in media outlets. When I say individual trust, everybody, whether it's left, right, whatever it is, I feel like we have to educate people in all sorts of mediums, whatever new medium there is. Let me ask you this. Where are you in docudrama? What did you make of the Chernobyl, which went that in that direction? Have you ever thought about it?
I have, and I've done it. I mean, I co-created and executive produced and directed the first episode of a dramatic series that was on Hulu called The Looming Tower.
Oh, right. That's right. Right. Looming Tower. Right.
It's a Pulitzer Prize winning nonfiction book.
And why do you think that was better as a docudrama than as a straight documentary?
There were certainly scenes that happened that you could have only gotten people to recollect, which would have been interesting in its own way, but you wouldn't have been able to feel the texture of the moment. And also to see through certain psychological moments and also moments of parallel narrative construction, how this stuff was all happening at the same time. So it was an ability to get inside the heads of certain characters and also to tell a story in a very compelling narrative fashion. So it's not like it couldn't have been told in a documentary. Anything can be, but it seemed that this story, which is actually a small portion of Larry's book, was best told as a drama.
What do you feel like you, when you make docudrama, what do you feel like you owe the viewer at the end? An explanation of, what do you owe the viewer?
I think you owe them an essential truth. And when you depart from the truth, I think you don't want to stop and put a footnote in the middle of a
correct. No, it's not. Yeah. I love what Chernobyl did. They did little mini docs. We had to make up this composite character. This is a composite character.
And by the way, the next time I do something, and we discussed this on Looming Tower, but for one reason or another, we couldn't do it. But the next time I do a drama like that, I'll post on a website, you know, a good compendium of where we strayed from the factual record, where we combined characters, and why. And then people can just watch the drama. But if they're curious as to how it relates to the actual facts, they can look it up.
Maybe this is a part of your secret, but man, how do you churn out as much stuff as you guys churn out? Like, how big is your team these days? And well, what kind of operation have you been able to create?
I mean, I have, there's two things. There's the films that I do, and I do a number of them, but I don't do any of them fast. I sometimes do, often do more than one at the same time.
I almost want to hear, how the hell do you do that? How do you keep your head straight on that?
Well, usually on each film, there is a small team who only works on that film. And yet, particularly when I get into the cutting room, I find it can be valuable until you get to the very, very end when all your attention has to be on, to move in and out of different stories, because you can see the narrative problems much more easily when you're moving from outside in rather than when you're, you know, your focus is on the trees all the time instead of the forest. So I found that to be a valuable technique. So like this film, Forever Prisoner, took 2 years to make. And there are a number of films I was working on at the same time. So that's how that works. In terms of my company, there are a number of projects I'm involved with or I help to get made with varying degrees of involvement. And there are a lot of very talented and powerful people at the company who do those projects. And very often we operate more as a boutique or as a kind of a studio, not as a machine, but as a Santa's workshop, you know, where people can come in and hopefully do their best work on their own. And we support them as we need to, as we can.
I'm guessing you must sift through multiple pitches a day. So how do you, you know, do you have a moment where you say, okay, I want to see the various ideas we've got this month and see what's worth launching on?
I mean, you know, there are people who are on staff at Jigsaw, and there's a very talented development exec named Joey Mara, who does a lot of that previewing. And obviously some things come directly through me, but yeah, like any, organization that's dealing with stories, whether it be a journalistic organization or a studio, you know, we sift through pitches and ideas on a regular basis and kind of try to decide which ones are worth spending our time on, which ones can we get made. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, we make very small, low budget ones and sometimes very high budget ones. It just kind of depends, and you weigh a lot of different factors.
Well, I was just going to say, the fact that you now have, you've been able to build a fairly large organization to bring it back to the Forever Prisoner. A smaller shop wouldn't have been able to fund these lawsuits, correct?
Yeah, the lawsuits actually weren't that expensive. In fact, by and large, they were born by the media, the MFIA, which is it's a kind of medium, it's media. I'm going to get it wrong, but it's the MFIA at the Yale Law School.
Gotcha.
And it's a great group that has done wonderful work in terms of helping journalists and filmmakers get access to information that the government is unfairly keeping. And it was the MFIA and also some people working pro bono at Ballard Spahr, a very good law firm, that really did all the heavy lifting at no expense to us in terms of getting some of this critical information.
Does this mean we get Ali Sufan's book more widely available?
Yeah, the unclassified
version
is now available. So you can and it's that's what it says on the banner. It's unclassified. So all those redactions of the first person singular pronoun, which is what the CIA did the first time around, are now gone.
Well, Alex, it's a very compelling story. It's a sad chapter, as you point out. And, you know, I have a feeling we're not done with this story. I mean, do you imagine you're going to end up, you know, delving into this topic one more time if Gitmo's still around?
Maybe. I think there are broad tendrils to this story, and there are reasons why this story matters ever more, even today. You know, as we wonder how much we should trust the government.
Yeah.
You know, it's a compelling tale and an agent provocateur to get the government to explain why they shouldn't be more forthcoming to us.
Well, we're going to host a summit about democracies around the world. I wonder if any of those folks are going to bring up the uncomfortable nature of Gitmo.
I'm sure they will.
Alex, congrats, my friend.
Thanks. Looking forward to it. Always a pleasure. All right. Take care, man.
You've been listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Gopin Green and Matt Rivera. John Reese is the executive producer, and theme music is composed by Spoke Media. You can catch Meet the Press daily on MSNBC every day at 1 Eastern. Meet the Press Reports is on demand on Peacock. And the big show is available every Sunday morning on any platform you want, including your local NBC station. Thanks for listening, and until we upload again.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.